Welcome to The Metabolic Link, a medical and science-focused podcast that explores the common thread of metabolism in health and disease. This is where science meets society.
So my focus was on exercise physiology, was the general overview area. I chose to explore some sort of unappreciated aspects of muscle adaptations to ketogenic diets. So pick three areas that I think there was some provocative data that either we had collected over the years or others. One was related to an unexpected normalization of glycogen levels in the context of a very low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, and how that might actually happen even though you're not eating a lot of carbohydrates, and why it might be important. Another one had to do with muscle production of ketones, which is a little bit controversial. And a little nuance of that was that muscle actually converts one of the ketone bodies, acetoacetate, into beta-hydroxybutyrate and releases it back into the circulation, which is interesting, but perhaps more important is that in the process provides a source of NAD plus for skeletal muscle. And this likely has a lot of positive benefits in terms of cellular function, and a lot of indications NAD plus is depleting and a function of age, for example, and maintaining levels is kind of a hot topic in terms of a lot of various supplements promoted to do that. So here's a natural way in which simply how the body processes ketones provides a sustained source of NAD for cells. And then the third area, what was the third area? It was the heart muscle, so cardiac muscle, and how a ketone-fueled heart in a variety of different areas of different disciplines have now shown that a ketone-fueled heart actually functions better. And this comes from animal studies, comes from now human studies. Most of these acute, so acutely elevating ketones, appears to improve cardiac output, both in terms of stroke volume and heart rate, contributing to that. But particular relevance here for patients with heart failure or some kind of impaired cardiac function, but it appears to also do so in healthy people, so could also be some applications there as well. Well, right now, in terms of the data on ketones and cardiac function, the results are very robust in terms of showing it across healthy and diseased populations. However, it's all acute in nature, meaning people have either elevated ketones by infusion. In the case of heart failure patients, they infuse a beta-hydroxybutyrate salt. More recently, there's been a couple papers published showing exogenous ketones, in particular ketone esters, single dose, elevate ketones and improve cardiac function as measured by echo or MRI. So what we don't know is how does this play out over repeated use, repeated elevation of ketones over days, weeks, months? Does the effect disappear, or is it augmented, or some other sort of temporal adaptation that happens? And so we're really excited at Ohio State because we have multiple projects underway that will address those questions in patients with heart failure, particularly preserved ejection fraction, for which it's about half of all heart failure patients, but there are really no therapeutic options for them, good ones anyway. So if we can show an effect here, this would be quite impactful. In terms of oxygen delivery in ketones, I don't think that's been measured directly in humans, to my knowledge. I know there's work showing improved efficiency. So in terms of ATP produced per unit oxygen in the heart, if it's running on ketones, that it's more efficient, so you can get more work done per unit oxygen. And that is important, especially for heart failure, where they're inefficient. And so I suspect something's going on metabolically, allowing for this improved cardiac function that has something to do with, you know, oxygen use anyway, but whether enhanced oxygen delivery to the peripheral tissues, maybe. There is a hemodynamic effect, so it's been shown cardiac dilation is improved with ketones. So that in and of itself could improve oxygen delivery. I mean, NAD, you know, this sort of redox reactions, NAD plus, NADH, are very short-lived. It's very challenging to measure directly, but there are some indirect measures of how to do that. So there are ways to do this. I think it's, you know, primarily animal studies where you can get access to tissues and kind of do things that you can't do easily in humans. It's part of the reason I presented it was to encourage people to pursue these things because it's quite, quite provocative with so much attention on NAD+. And this is, I don't hear a lot of people talking about these studies that convincingly show that this peripheral conversion of acetoacetate to beta-hydroxybutyrate occurs in cells, because what the liver is producing is actually equal amounts, approximately equal amounts of acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate. But if you take a blood sample at any given time in a person and measure all their ketones, so beta-hydroxybutyrate, acetoacetate, and then acetone is also a ketone, but at much lower concentrations, beta-hydroxybutyrate is by far the predominant ketone. So you have to ask why. You know, why is it 80% of all ketones? And that alone provides the answer that, you know, what's coming out of the liver is not 80% BHB, but what ends up in the peripheral circulation, the venous blood draw or capillary finger stick, is predominantly BHB. So I think the question of, I use the term nutritional ketosis, which just simply is a state of being in higher levels of ketones, typically 0.5 to 5, does not necessarily equate with keto adaptation, which is really a catch-all term that describes all the physiologic metabolic adaptations that occur over time. And we're just starting to unravel and understand all the various adaptations that occur to being on a ketogenic diet that allows you to be in nutritional ketosis over periods of weeks, months, years. So for example, when you start a ketogenic diet, most people can elevate their ketones in 1 or 2 days and keep them elevated. That doesn't mean you're keto-adapted. Same with exogenous ketones now, which are newer. You can acutely elevate your ketones and be eating carbohydrate. And I would argue, even if you do that over weeks and months, you're not going to technically keto-adapt, because one of the fundamental metabolic adaptations to a ketogenic diet, so being in a sustained carbohydrate-restricted diet that elevates your ketones, is that you become a prodigious fat burner. And this occurs almost across the board. If you're an elite athlete, it happens. If you're a type 2 diabetic that's very metabolically inflexible, it happens. And it's about a doubling of your absolute fat oxidation rates. And that, to me, that's sort of the hallmark physiological adaptation to keto adaptation, but that doesn't happen with exogenous ketones. If anything, they might actually inhibit a little bit fat oxidation, just because we know ketones, through negative feedback inhibition, modestly block fat breakdown or adipose tissue lipolysis, so decreasing substrate for ketone production. Do ketones suppress lipolysis in skeletal muscle? I know the receptors for ketones exist on adipose tissue, and so we have good evidence that there's some modest breaking of fat breakdown occurring. But as far as fatty acid uptake and oxidation in skeletal muscle, I'm not aware of anyone who's demonstrated those receptors exist in skeletal muscle, and any mechanistic link between ketones and, say, hormone-sensitive lipase, or some of the enzymes involved in beta oxidation or in lipolysis in skeletal muscles. So the FASTER study was, that was done over a decade ago now. I think the work was done over a decade ago. We published it around 2015. I've done a lot of experiments over 25 years, and I have to say that one holds a special place in my heart because it was just so fun. And we had such great participants come from all over the country, all over the world actually, on a pretty elite level, and come to the lab and go through some pretty invasive and, you know, quite a rigorous 3 days of testing. And we learned a heck of a lot. I'm a little disappointed in myself. We haven't followed up on it and done FASTER 2.0, but it's not an area that receives a lot of funding. I mean, ketogenic diet research in general doesn't bring in the big dollars in most cases. But if you look at the niche area of exercise performance, I'd say it's even less. So that has been one of the barriers. But there's certainly a lot of athletes abandoning their carb loading and utilizing lower carbohydrate diets. So I do see a slow shift from the carb-centric model that's, you know, existed since the 60s and the invention of carb loading and all that. There's still a lot of work to go, because I really think athletes don't need to be consuming as much carbohydrate as we've been telling them, which has basically been eat as much as you possibly can before, during, and after exercise. So I think the more appropriate way to think about it is eat as less carbohydrate as you can and still maximize your performance and your health. And that's probably a different level for everyone depending on their genetics and where they're at in their training, you know, programs and so forth. So it's a slightly different perspective, but still in the minority on that one. So there's only a couple labs I'm aware of really pushing the exercise performance, even though I think it's gaining a lot of grassroots attention, especially in the ultra-endurance world and a few team sports. So there's been some really interesting data out challenging the conventional high-carb approach, but a lot of work to do yet. My focus has been a little bit more on the clinical side, looking at different clinical populations, but also military performance. So that kind of gets into the exercise performance, because the soldiers are out there, not that different than elite athletes in some cases in terms of their physiological demands. So we're trying to design studies and test hypotheses related to various ketogenic interventions that would make them more resilient and be able to tolerate stress better, in terms of maintaining their physical as well as their neurocognitive performance. So, for example, we have a couple studies underway using sleep restriction as a model of stress. A lot of soldiers are sleep deprived, and so are a lot of the general population, so it's a very relevant stressor. And it's very well documented that that deteriorates your physical and cognitive performance. And the hypothesis we're testing is whether either exogenous ketones would mitigate or attenuate some of that decline, as well as a more prolonged ketogenic diet. And so stay tuned on those studies. But we've tried to make it military relevant too. So instead of doing some of the standard Wingate bike tests and so forth, soldiers don't really care if you improve that. We've designed some tactical tests. For example, we have a virtual shooting house where we validated good reliability, day-to-day shooting performance. And so that's relevant. And we do a few other things that I think the military will appreciate more if we're able to improve. Well, most of my active studies at Ohio State are in the area of kind of complications of type 2 diabetes. So we've already shown, you know, we can reverse type 2 diabetes, and it's remarkable, and it's probably the most important thing I've done in my career, because unfortunately type 2 diabetes is so rampant across not just the United States but the country, and there's just so much personal suffering, so much financial burden associated with managing diabetes. So that is near and dear to my heart, and so the problem there is more just getting people to having access to this information, getting the medical community to get on board, and then also sustainability of the diet for people. It's still a challenge to maintain a ketogenic diet over the long term, and especially with type 2 diabetes, you have to have the physician in the loop. because of the need for safety and medication management on the ketogenic diet. And it's all quite complicated, and physicians are just simply not taught this information. So still a tremendous amount of ignorance, but it's more about education and accessibility and helping patients maintain the ketogenic diet over the long term, because most of them need to. They can't necessarily go back to eating a moderate carb or Mediterranean diet. Some can, but majority of them, a lot of them need to stay on the ketogenic diet for a lifetime. And we've been tracking patients at Virta Health well over 5 years now, managing tens of thousands of patients. So we have a lot of experience with this, but unfortunately there's tens of millions of people just in the United States with type 2 diabetes, and it's a big problem. But at Ohio State, we're, the big problem with diabetes is over time, you don't really pass away from diabetes. You develop complications of diabetes, and the two big ones that really dramatically decrease your health span are heart failure and chronic kidney disease. So we have studies underway in both those populations to understand if we can actually get at some of those disease processes. And hopefully, we're just planting the seeds now and doing these studies in these populations, but I really believe if I can do this in my career, I'll be happy. We need to show hard outcomes. Incredibly challenging studies to do that, because typically you have to track people for many years and have a high enough N size to begin with so that you have enough statistical power. But we do have studies underway that we hope we're going to be able to track people over many years and actually look at least at maybe hospitalizations or cardiac events, perhaps even mortality, because I think for some people quite resistant to this information, that's what it's going to take to really kind of get this information, get this concept into the mainstream and actually change medical practice. Well, it certainly is a big part, yeah. And there's enough data out there now where we don't have to generate necessarily more data to start educating, because we know this is safe for the most part, and at least in diabetes, we have a lot of studies now. So it really is about education and helping people at least present this to patients as an option. Not saying, this is the only therapy, but that's sort of the hallmark of a physician, is making sure patients understand all their options. And at the end of the day, they make their decision, but that's generally not being done now. So it's not even presented as an option. So that, that comes back to changing the medical curriculum and somehow reaching physicians and teaching them, because I don't think that's taught in any medical curriculums right now. So it's just the curious ones that go out there and kind of learn this on their own that are able to try to implement this into their practices. Yeah, in terms of educating physicians, it's going to take a while to integrate the scientific information we have out there into the standard medical curriculums. But in the meantime, I think there's a lot of value in groups like Metabolic Health Initiative or other organizations that are really embracing all this science around low-carb nutrition and ketogenic nutrition to provide that information in one resource, because there's a lot of information out on the internet, and even for those physicians that are curious about lifestyle, including low-carb nutrition and so forth, to have a place they can go to that they know is credible and learn this on their own, that's certainly a good segue. But eventually, I would hope we can convince the gatekeepers that control the curriculums in all the med schools that we need to teach this to physicians. And I think the young ones are very hungry for this information, because most doctors, I think, get into medicine for good, very good, noble reasons. They want to help patients. And a lot of them are frustrated because a lot of the current therapies don't work. And when they use, this potent therapy, it's quite rewarding, because it can be quite transformative for patients with diabetes. And it really, really, I don't know, just even as a researcher, it's very rewarding to hear a lot of the success stories where you change somebody's life. I mean, it's nice to publish papers and, you know, get that satisfaction from doing all the work and grinding through the experiments, but actually helping people and translating that information's way better. Well, I think in terms of my main sort of dream in terms of what I can contribute to humanity as a scientist who's been studying low-carb nutrition for, I think, 25, almost 30 years, is that we can help people. There's a lot of people suffering. I mean, the statistics on obesity and diabetes are just unbelievable, and it's generally no indications it's getting better. And this has been happening since about 1980, where it really spiked, but it's been continuing to go up, and there's just tens of millions of people, over 100 million people with weight problem in the U.S., and over 100 million people with either pre-diabetes or diabetes. It's actually one in two adults have either type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, so they're on the fast track to developing diabetes. So that's just incredible, and there's many people in my life, family, friends, neighbors, that I run into every day that are struggling, and providing a solution, even if I can help a few of them, is incredibly rewarding. And as a trained scientist, the best way I can do that is continue to do the science, disseminate the science as best I can, and I think feel like we've made some progress in over time, and so. You know, my big dream is, I guess, being a little more specific, is we can integrate this science into medical practice. That's such a hard thing to do. And never thought it would take 20 years after I published my first study to, you're just naive and think everyone will read this and things will change. But, it takes a lot to change, especially in medicine, where it's a lot of resistance to change, but we're getting there.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Metabolic Link. If you're enjoying this podcast, please share, subscribe, follow, and leave us a comment or review on whichever platform you use to tune in. We hope you'll join us next time.